We are in Genesis chapter 35. Last time in our study, we looked at what happened with what two brothers? Do you remember what's 34? What two brothers of Jacob's sons does it focus on? Simeon and Levi. Remember? And what happened with Dinah? And the act that was the evil that was brought against her, and then their reaction to that. Well, so that's chapter 34. And so at that moment, where is the family living? Right, they're in the land of the Canaanites, right? And so this is the land of Canaan. This attack happens. Now, what would be the natural result? Do you remember what does Jacob say to Simeon and Levi in verse 30? In his rebuke of them, part of that rebuke was about what? It'd be how the people would react to them. And so, as you get into chapter 35 and verse 1, what's Jacob doing? He's leaving, right? He's getting out of the area. Verse 1 says, God said to Jacob, "Arise, go to Bethel and dwell there. Make an altar there to the Lord who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau." So it calls back to our minds the flight of Jacob to where? To where?
Laban.
Yeah, to Laban, right? In Ur of the Chaldeans, that area, as he traveled back north. Well, it says in that flight, of course, he traveled through Bethel. There was an altar there. By this point, it seems like that altar may be gone. We'll see that in a minute. Or at least not the altar, but the memorial stones that were put there. So he said, go back to Bethel. So he's going to travel north. I don't have my pointer. Anyway, he's going to travel north. You can see Bethel up there. Is he in Shechem? That would be south, if I'm wrong. Let's see. Was he in Shechem? Yes, I'm sorry. He'll be traveling south. So you can see, let me grab my pointer. You can see he's not going very far, but here's Shechem here, and he's going to travel south down to Bethel. Now, why is Bethel significant to a New Testament Christian? Where's Bethel located near?
Jerusalem,
right? And so here's Bethel. Bethel. Now, right here, you can see behind the words there is the what sea? What sea? Sea of Galilee. I think actually this is the Dead Sea, isn't it? Here. Wait, am I right? I'm getting my geography all mixed up. Yeah, it's the Dead Sea, right south of Jerusalem. And so Bethel's right there at the top of it, about where Jerusalem would end up being. That's significant biblically, right? A lot of stuff happens in this area. So just kind of keep that in mind. So they're moving to Bethel, and God says what? When you get there, what should you do? You should build an altar. Altars are used for what? For worship, right? Sacrifice, but ultimately for worship. And another thing that's kind of important, I'm not going to deal with everything in 35, but we noted this earlier. Prior to Jacob returning back home, how did he see God? His relationship with God? It was his father's God and his grandfather's God. But that began to change around what time? Do you remember?
Laban?
It was after he'd left Laban, but remember wrestling with the Lord? Those things seemed to change. A part of that wrestling with the Lord was what? Well, he received a name change. We're going to see that come back up. So just kind of keep that in mind. So his name was changed from Jacob to Israel. All right, so a lot tied up here. All right, so he flees away from the possibly vengeful Canaanites, and he travels to Bethel. Now notice verse 2. What does Jacob say to his household? All right, so what do we still see them struggling with? Idolatry, right? Now, we've seen this already, even as far back as Abraham, who left the Mesopotamian area, which was highly influenced by idolatry, right? And so he grew up in that, but then he flees. Well, Jacob, even now, and we saw it with his wife, which one?
Rachel.
She has the idolatrous little god that she brings with her. Right? Idolatry is still something that they're struggling to get rid of. However, here, Jacob says, put away the foreign gods that are among you. Purify yourselves and change your garments. That's an interesting kind of sequence there, isn't it? It's, number one, he says, put away foreign gods. Then you're to do what? Secondly, you purify yourselves. Now, I was looking at that purifying comment. One commentator said this probably included ceremonial washing, so an actual washing, but also abstinence from normal sexual activity and contemplation. I've kind of talked with Miss Fagina a few times about fasting. This is a similar concept to what's going on here. It's a time of abstaining from some things while doing what? What's that? While praying or contemplating God. All right, so it's concentrated effort to contemplate their relationship with God. So he says, purify yourselves. So it involves probably all three of those elements. And then he says, purify yourselves and then do what? Change your garments. Now, later on in the law of Moses, with the priest, what did it call for the priest to do whenever they would go to offer sacrifice? Before they ever went to do the sacrifice, what was the first thing they would have to do?
Wash.
Change your clothes, right? That was significant. Now, what is God teaching them? Well, God never fully explains this, but I do find it interesting, and I see the symbolic parallelism with what we do in Christianity. In becoming a child of God, what is that act? But doing what? If I go to Romans chapter 6, and I look at verses 3 and 4, when Paul says to the Romans, you were baptized, what does he remind them of in that baptism? What were they doing?
Washing away their sins.
Yeah, they're washing away, they're purifying themselves by getting rid of the old self, and then they were to, once they got rid of the old self, then what happens? Put on the new self. Galatians 3:27 pictures it this way. He says, for as many of you were baptized, have done what? You've clothed yourselves. That idea of clothing, right? You're putting on this this garment which covers you. Well, here in Genesis 35, Jacob says to his family, you need to purify yourselves and change your garments. You probably experienced this. You ever been doing something where you're working or you're you're out having fun or something, but you get really dirty. You ever done that? How does it feel to take a shower? Isn't that a nice feeling? Like, if I ever get in that situation, I'm not one who can just go to bed and go to sleep. I've got to feel that cleaning, that renewal of my flesh. Well, of course, as becoming Christian, the meaning is so much deeper. Peter says, 1 Peter 3:20, he says that in baptism, it's not like the washing of the body. He says, baptism now saves us, not the what? Removal of the filth of the flesh, but an answer of a good conscience toward God. And so Jacob says to his people, we need to purify ourselves by changing our garments. And so it's a change of mindset. And then it's at that point, only after they've done that, that he says in verse 3, then let us arise and go up to Bethel so that I may make there an altar to the God who answers me in the day of my distress and has been with me wherever I've gone. So he says, once we've purified ourselves, once we've changed our garments, then we can do what? We can go worship God. But we're not going to go worship God in the state we're in. Verse 4, in the actual act of purifying themselves, you'll note it says, so they gave to Jacob all the foreign gods that they had, and the rings that were in their ears. Is God against earrings? No, it's not what he's talking about here. What earrings is he referring to? Most likely, what I understand, these were idolatrous little amulets that they would wear that were emblematic of the idolatrous religions of their day. And so God wanted them to get rid of those things in their purification process. And it says, Jacob then hid them under the terebinth tree near Shechem. So before they ever left Shechem and went to Bethel, they first purified themselves so that when they got there, they then could offer worship to God. Any question about that section? All right, so like I said, I'm not going to cover every bit of this, but they move along. They come to Luz, which is Bethel. I read one thing where this is probably Bethlehem. Of course, that has special significance to us. But they travel to Bethel, and there, verse 7, he builds the altar. And he called the name of the place El Bethel. Now, in your Hebrew understanding, El Bethel means what?
What?
God's house, or God, the God of Bethel, right? So El, you just remember El is a reference to God when you see that, and so has some reference to God. So here, the God of Bethel, So earlier, you remember that when he wrestles with him at Bethel, right? God revealed himself there to Jacob. So you go a little bit later in that text. Go down to verse 10. So God, verse 9, God appears to Jacob when he comes to Padanaram. And there he blesses him. And then verse 10, God said to him, your name is Jacob. What did Jacob mean?
Forever.
Heel grabber, exactly. It meant heel grabber. But God says, no longer shall your name be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name. So he called his name Israel. Do you remember what Israel means? To wrestle with God, right? Wrestle with God. And so this is a very significant name change. A whole nation of people come out of this, known by this name. And it's also very significant because God makes the change. It wasn't that Jacob just randomly decided, I want to be called something different. But God gave him this name. And it was initially spoken when he wrestled with the Lord. Now is confirmed or reaffirmed here in chapter 35. And he says to him, he repeats the blessings that he had been said to Abraham and Isaac. These are continued on to Jacob as well.
So verse 4, please.
Maybe. Oh. No, go ahead. I'm just kidding.
Back up here in verse 7, God also, I remember that God, when he's here, that God also appeared to Jacob when he was fleeing from his brother.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I remember that, but it says it there.
Yeah, so it's the third time he's appeared to him, okay. Right? And so the three different appearances. I believe they're all in Bethel. Any other things? Good point. And so you remember when Jacob comes in the area, it's known as Luz, but verse 15 tells us that Jacob actually changes the name to Bethel. He sets up a stone pillar there as a memorial of what's happened. The end of the chapter deal with the death of Rachel and of Isaac. It says in verse 16, they journeyed from Bethel, so they leave Bethel, and they were still some distance from Ephrath, and Rachel went into labor. She had a hard labor, and when her labor was at its hardest, the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, for you have another son." And as her soul was departing, for she was dying, she called his name Ben-Oni. Interesting. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But his father called him Benjamin. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. I think I said that wrong earlier. Bethel is not Bethlehem, but Ephrath, which is a little bit further south. I don't think it's up there on the board. So Rachel, the beloved wife of Jacob, now Israel, has died. She died giving birth to Benjamin. Now, the name that Rachel had called him was what? Ben-Oni. Does anybody know what Ben-Oni means?
Son of my sorrow.
Son of my sorrow. At first when I read that, I'm like, well, his mother gave him his name. Why would Jacob change his name? Well, that's a heavy label to put on a child, right?
Yeah.
Son of my sorrow. You don't want to, every time you look at Benjamin, to be reminded of the death of Rachel, right? It's already going to be there with every birthday that comes. Of course, they didn't celebrate birthdays the same way we do, but you know, every renewal of that, you're thinking about her death. And so Jacob decides to call him Benjamin. Anybody know what Benjamin means?
Son of my writing,
and you're cheating, aren't you? I can look. See, if she wasn't cheating and looking, getting the answer, she wouldn't be laughing right now. But the guilt overwhelms her soul. Just kidding. You're exactly right. The son of my right hand. And I read one thing where this probably infers the idea that whereas son of sorrow is one of those, is a negative thing, son of my right hand probably refers to that every time Jacob looks at him, he's taking courage in the memory of his beloved wife. And so the idea there is comfort. He's going to take comfort in Benjamin in the midst of his sorrow. Just kind of an interesting wordplay there between the two. So Rachel passes away. You'll notice that she's not buried in the tomb with the rest of the family. She's actually buried in Bethlehem. Unlike where Jacob will rest, even Joseph himself will end up in the cave where Abraham was, where Sarah was buried. Rachel does not. And so it says that a pillar, verse 20, Jacob set up a pillar over her tomb. It is the pillar of Rachel's tomb, which is there to this day. Of course, he's talking about the day Moses wrote it, not our day. But in the time Moses wrote this, that pillar was still standing. Kind of an amazing thing. And it would have been something that the people of Moses' day could go back and view and remember Rachel. The next thing is not so positive. Anything about that, though, before I go to the negative? We've had two sons get into trouble. Now we're going to get a third. And I don't know which one's worse. They're all kind of negative. But you have Reuben. Where does Reuben stand in the line of succession? He's number one, right? He's the oldest, the son of Leah, the first child. Well, verse 22 tells us that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. Now, that's all that's stated in this section. However, if we venture over to chapter 49, what is the result of this act? He loses his inheritance. If you go to Genesis 49, verse 3, I'm going to steal from that study real quickly. This is the blessings, and you could maybe say cursings, that are laid upon the children of Israel. Israel says to Reuben, verse 3, "You are my firstborn, my might, and the first fruits of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power, unstable as water." And then here you get to the actual blessing or cursing, if you will. "Unstable as water, you shall not have preeminence." What does it mean to be preeminent? It means you're first, right? You're first in the line of succession. Who should have received the greatest inheritance from his father? Well, it should have been Reuben. He's not going to have that preeminence. He's lost that. He says, "Because you went up to your father's bed and then you defiled it, he went up to my couch." And so he has lost that right. You can go on and look at Simeon and Levi. They also, if you keep reading, he says, verse 7, "Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, for their wrath, for it is cruel. And I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." And so they, like Reuben, have lost their birthright as well. So the birthright, the preeminent birthright, goes to Judah. Now, for them, that was important because it immediately affected them and it would affect their descendants. But for us, why is that significant? Jesus did not come through Reuben. He did not come through Simeon. He did not come through Levi. He came through Judah. I know we're about to ring the bell. I'm just going to finish out this chapter. This is not where I expected to be. I expected to be in 37, but we didn't get there. But I do want to go to verse 27. I'll let you read some of the other things there in verses 22 through 26. But in 27, you have the death of Isaac. Text says, and Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre, or Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. Now the days of Isaac were 180, and Isaac breathed his last, and he died and was gathered to his people,
old and full of days.
And his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. And so you may remember. What? I'm sorry. Oh yeah, we stayed in that same chapter. So if you were in 35, you were probably close. But you have the death of Isaac. Now you remember about 40 years earlier, it looked like he may have felt he was getting ready to pass, but he lived another 40 years beyond the time that he sent Jacob away. And then the text says he died full of old and full of days. So he had a pretty lengthy life at 180. That's a long time, isn't it? I think about Brother Billy, you know, he passed away, he's 94. That's a really ripe old age in our context. Well, Isaac lived to 180. And then, of course, you have the two sons, Esau and Jacob, burying him, being able to reunite those two brothers. Their descendants are going to struggle to be united, but at least the two brothers at the end of Isaac's life were able to be there together. Questions, comments?
Isn't off the top of my head, but isn't Isaac one of the longest? After him, the days are shorter. They're much shorter.
So I'm going off memory, but I believe that's true. I think he's like the last.
I mean, Joseph's like 110. I don't remember about Noah.
And I think Jacob was, 120, I think.
But that's still shorter than 180.
Yeah. How old did you say Moses was?
120.
So, and I think Jacob was 120. You double check me on that. I may be wrong. But yeah, you're right. You know, you do see a significant drop in age. There's an age chart. You can find it online, and we have it around here somewhere, where it shows the ages prior to the flood and then after. And of course,
you have Noah living to
600. Is it 600? I think it's right. Is it 9? He lived 600 after the flood. That's what, I'm sorry, I'm getting that confused. But then after Noah, you look at that chart and the ages really drastically decrease over the coming next few generations. Until you get to the time around Moses and those times, you know, they start to settle out after Moses, not be so lengthy, more akin to what we experience today. But 180 even was a long time. And you compare it to Noah, and you're looking at 950? Is that it? 950, that was a good long time.
You know, later when Joseph has his dreams, you know, the dreams and he tells his dad, and his dad says, do you think me and your mother are going to do that? I mean, his mother's been dead for a long time. I mean, so is he considering Leah his mother now?
No. So, all right. We'll have to deal with that when we get there. but it may... So remember, he's... In Genesis, not writing necessarily for chronological order. Sometimes things are topical the way he talks about them. So we'll talk more about that next week. I need to explore that issue a little bit of why he says that.